Hello.
Hi.
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 Hello.
I'm curious about.
I'm curious about.
I'm curious about.
I'm curious about.
I'm curious about building open, authentic, loving relationship.
I'm curious about jealousy.
I'm curious about polyamory.
Does it just mean that you're fucking all the time?
How can I tell my parents that my partner is already married?
I'm curious about...
How do you know when you're too busy to have another relationship?
I'm curious about dominant and subordinate relationships.
I'm curious about sexual health.
How can relationships evolve with people as they grow and change?
The fact that you just referenced DC Talk brought such flashbacks to DC Talk. Is a Christian like rap pop band.
Is that right?
And I like
that's a song about purity culture,
yeah,
and not
I went to their concerts when I was young and everything. Yeah.
I can't wait for this conversation. Welcome to the Curious Folks podcast. This podcast is for those who challenge the status quo in love, sex, and relationships. My name is Effie Bloom.
And I'm Jacqueline Mislaw. And in today's episode, we're speaking with Marie de Elefant about religion, socialization, sexuality, and the journey of untangling ourselves from the systems that we have been born into. Marie is the host of Everyone's Autonomous podcast, a show that explores our religious past and focuses on how it impacts our present, as well as how we can fight for autonomy of others right now. She's also a life coach, an ethical non-monogamy educator, an autonomy educator, and a photographer. Marie, we are very excited to be talking.
I'm very excited to be talking to you. It was hard to get recording because we were so busy chatting. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, welcome, Marie. Welcome. Really good to have you. We're very excited.
Thank you.
We started talking to you because you reached out to us, which is perfect. We love that. And you told us your story and you said, I come from a very religious background and I found my way out and now I'm free and I'm living my life and I'm helping other people do the same. So what I would love to start us off with, just a bit of a chronology of your story and what your experience was, and that sort of brings us up to today. And then we'd love to delve into your thoughts on the role of religion in our expressions around sex and relationships and all that good juicy stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say I don't consider myself free necessarily. I just consider myself aware and going against the flow of a dominating stream. Mm-hmm. But, and that's, you know what, in this world, if that's what freedom is, if that's the most freedom that we can have, then okay. So as far as my story goes, I'm 38. And so I was born in Minnesota at the age of being born. And so I was raised in, I'm white. I was raised in a family that was Lutheran at the time. So, you know, going into the basements and eating hot dishes and, you know, casseroles and that kind of thing. And just that very muted white culture of the Midwest, of not being passive, of being passive aggressive, of not really talking about feelings and not really getting angry either. And so I was raised Lutheran, and then eventually we switched over to a kind of like a Baptist sort of thing. And I had a tough childhood, I would say, on a scale. It wasn't terrible, but respectively, it was tough because I've noticed a lot of things about myself that were never really addressed when I was younger because my family wasn't very informed around psychological issues. And so there's a lot of things that I could have used help with, a lot of insecurities, a lot of obsessive behaviors, a lot of shame that I was dealing with even as a kid. And then on top of that, you layer the type of Christianity that I was raised in, which was very shame-based. So tell someone with OCD tendencies that if they don't think the right thing, they're going to be in pain for eternity. So that is traumatic. So I took it very seriously. I struggled to develop critical thinking skills as a child, and there's a lot of factors involved in that. I think one is being raised as a woman in this culture. You are not encouraged nor expected to be highly intellectual. You are not nurtured in that way. Your standards are set a lot lower. And additionally, I have a different way of learning, a different learning style that is very different than mainstream educational style. It would have been something that teachers would have needed to recognize and give me very specific directed assistance on, and that never happened. And so throughout my childhood, education was a very anxious thing. It was very performative, just doing my best to memorize things, but never really critically consume them or realize why I was learning this stuff and why did I have to memorize this stuff and then vomit it back out at them? Why was that the requirement? So none of my childhood was like, hey, welcome to Earth. We don't know what's going on, but here's some an accumulation of the knowledge that we've, you know, gathered up until now. Usually this knowledge gets debunked as time goes by, so don't hold on to it too tightly. You know, like that's how I would have wanted to be greeted on Earth. And instead, I was greeted with a very rigid way of viewing things. From day one, my family was, you know, subtly telling me that they've already answered all of the existential questions that there are, which is absurd at the age of 38 now, being like, how can you say that? Like, how can you tell a child, hey, welcome, we know what's going on.
And frankly, probably whatever you don't know, we shouldn't be asking.
Exactly.
If we don't know the answer, if it wasn't written in the Bible and it wasn't said from the pulpit, then we should not be asking that question.
Exactly.
Or God says so, right? That's the other answer I hear from people.
Yes.
You know, why is it like that? Why is it like that? God says so. It seems to be like, if there's no real answer, that seems to be the default answer that gets dished out.
Right. It's, I don't know if what you would call it, maybe intellectual laziness or something. It's just what it is. It's just what it is. It's just humanity does. I've been reading an intro to philosophy book recently, and there was one chapter that talked about the distinction between philosophy and religion, because religion exercises that exploration of answers to these existential questions, the questions of the human condition, and philosophy does that too. But the distinction is that religion, in addition to valuing a certain extent of reason, it also says that sources such as personal revelation and scripture can be considered as evidence in this exploration of existential questions. And reason is valued, but only up to a certain point, and then it is looked down upon. And so that's the kind of religion that I grew up in, whereas a lot of people grew up in a religion that was more relaxed and a lot more kind of on the philosophical side of things and less authoritarian, and like we're taking things that we can't even see and counting them as evidence.
Sure. I think one of the things you said, I don't know why people do that. I don't know why humans do that. My guess is actually that it's to do with our tolerance to ambiguity and our need for meaning and certainty in a world that is otherwise chaotic. And I think religious serves, at least this is what I view. So we'll cover this a little bit. We have all three of us have different backgrounds, and you and Marie, you and Jackie have a similar background in terms of religion. And I don't, I come from a very secular background. What I'm noticing, people who are so engrossed in religion, that it also on some level goes towards their tolerance for ambiguity, that the religion gives them certainty. And where there isn't certainty, like you said, there is this higher power that just knows better, you know? And I think it's soothing for those who find the chaos to be fear-invoking, right? We the ambiguity, the unknown, these are scary. Not knowing what's coming up is scary. And I think religion kind of gives you a bit of a, it seems to be an antidote to that. I think that's what's kind of happening. And I didn't, so certainly my background is, you know, my parents are very, you know, secular. Religion was discussed as more of theology around the dinner table. We, you know, discussed all different religions, and it was always couched in more academia or understanding, and never really in worship or as a scripture or anything like that. So we're, you know, the conversations would be about, here are the Abrahamic, you know, religions, and then here is your, you know, more philosophical religions and that kind of thing. So that's where I come from. Jackie, you have a very different experience. Just to set context.
Yes. Very different experience. So it's interesting because beforehand, we've talked before, Marie, and even in preparation for this podcast, we were doing a sound check and you started singing a DC Talk song and it just brought back. So those of you out there who grew up in the Christian faith, and so DC Talk is a like hip hop, rap, pop
Christian band from like the 90s. I don't know if they're still singing songs. No, they're not.
I think two of them have deconverted by now.
Is that right? Yeah. So I grew up also like Marie from a Christian background, Pentecostal. So there is the Catholic sect of Christianity, and then there's the Protestant sect of Christianity within there. Then there's all these subsects. So Baptist and Lutheran and Pentecostal and Evangel, and there's all these different, and we kind of moved between the evangelistic Christianity and Pentecostal Christianity, which is very focuses a lot on like the Holy Spirit, which is inside of you, and feeling the Holy Spirit, and of course sin and hell and all and shame and all of those, you know, classic Christian, like we had it, we were soaked into all of those things. And so much of what you're saying, Marie, has resonated, because I'm interested in your journey and your story around this. Like, sexuality has always been a part of who I am, like just naturally. And there was such shame around that. And so to your point around, you're telling someone who thinks differently, like, don't think that way or don't think at all. I was, you know, being told, don't feel anything. Don't feel anything in your body. Everything that your body is feeling is wrong. So God made you and God made everything about you, but you're also bad and wrong. And you're in God's image, but you're bad and you're wrong and should control yourself. And so there was this weird mixed message around that. And it messed with me in terms of things like masturbation and sexual fantasy. And, but to your point, two messages that stayed with me from my youth were that A, you could not question things, right? Like you, if you thought something and you thought, wow, this doesn't make any sense. Like, number one, God could hear your thoughts, and God, like Santa, and God is mad, right? Like, so just like Santa, and you're going to get some coal, like come when Jesus returns, like you're going to have to reconcile with all those bad thoughts. And second, and I'm curious if you heard this somewhere along in my childhood, it was told to me that the devil couldn't read my thoughts, but he could hear my words. Mm. And so even though God could hear my thoughts and I had to be careful what I was thinking, it was worse if I said it out loud, because then the devil would know, and the devil would like know, like, I got you. So even if I allowed myself space in my brain to question things or ask or to challenge things, I couldn't say it out loud, because then like the devil would have known that I was his and his plan had worked. And so it just was
so fucked up.
To get you not to talk. Yeah. 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 And I remember, and I was telling Effie, like, I'm 39, probably a few weeks ago, I was thinking about something. I can't remember what it was. And I remember thinking to myself in that moment, you can't say that out loud, because then the devil will know. I'm almost 40 years old. And I haven't been like in that, saturated in that for so long. But it goes back to what you were saying. And I want you to talk more about that, Marie, that you're actually never free from it.
Yeah. So I do want to just go back, just because I did have a thought in response to what Effie, you were saying about existential anxiety and stuff. I guess all I wanted to express is that I have this ideal for humanity that we would embrace distress and embrace ambiguity, because maybe we're not coded to do that, but we've overcome a lot of other fucking things. And so if we would value being unsure, being agnostic, not being able to ever have answers, and to nurture a culture that valued that, like, that would be my happy place, where people were safe to ask questions and people were safe to not get answers, and to sit with each other and comfort each other in the not knowing, and to hold each other's hands as the end of the world comes and you don't know what happens next, but just being like, I don't have the answers to this, and I'm going to breathe. And I feel like I'm on my way towards tolerating the distress of chaos and unknowing in the universe, and I'm doing it. It can be done. It can be done to build up that resilience, but it needs to be a value. It needs to be something that is put forward to you as, here's something, welcome to Earth. Right away, you're going to want to work on getting comfortable with discomfort, because nobody knows what's going on. So like, it can be done, but people need to value building up that resistance. And that's a lot of emotional intelligence. That's a lot of self-care and being present with discomfort and allowing it to just to be felt, because it will pass. It will pass. So that's just one thing I wanted to mention on that. In regards to the way that we were raised, at least Jacqueline and me, to not question things, that we are bad, that we are wrong. Yeah, that this is all true for me. I was taught, and this verse in the Bible was quoted a lot, and I don't remember what verse it is because I don't give a fuck, but it was about that our heart is a wicked and deceitful thing. Mm-hmm. So my flavor of Christianity was, you are terrible. Your ancestors ate a fruit. I have not seen any Christian diets that were anti-fruit, so I don't know why they're not being fundamentalists about that. But that's not even the point. But so you're bad because you disobeyed God, and then you were born of people who disobeyed God, and you're just inherently sinful. You're sinful as soon as you're born, and probably even before. Like, you're just sinful from day one. And I had no issue with that. I was like, yep, that makes sense. And it fed into my insecurity as well.
I guess you're born from sin, right? Because you're born because of sex, and sex is sinful. So you are born from sin, come into the world sinful. It's crazy. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I don't know if that was our doctrine behind it, that we were sinful because they had sex. Like, I think God was cool with sex so long as you put a ring on it and didn't do butt stuff. Like, that was the big thing. But I never really thought about that. Like, are we born sinful or are we born from sin? But like, the messaging that I integrated was that just from the get-go, you're sinful, and almost to an extent, like, don't really worry about it. Like, you're just sinful. Just accept that part. Don't get too fixated on that part, because we got the solution for you. And so they create the problem by telling you that you're sinful. If you're insecure, if you're being raised in a world that gives you any reason to feel insecure, which it does, you're going to glom onto that. And I did. I believed it, and it seemed right. It aligned with how I felt about myself. I was like, I'm a wicked, horrible thing. I felt that way about my intellect. I felt that way among my peers. It just exacerbated a natural insecurity that I had that should have been treated in therapy. Instead, it was fed by these messages of innate sinfulness in Christianity. And so I internalized those messages. And I remember, I think the messages that I received, there was never really a distinction between, like, can Satan hear your thoughts versus Satan can only hear the things that you say? Because then, like, what do you just make up, like, a make-believe language so that, like, because then are we getting into, like, some German World War II, like, coming up with, like, special codes so that Satan can't understand the things that you're saying? Like, beep, beep, boop, bop, bop, bop. Oh, and Satan's like, oh, shit.
Decoding things.
I don't know what she's saying. And, like, what a human thing to think that, like, this, there's an invisible thing, and the only way it knows what you're thinking is because of the throat grunts that you're making with your lip face thing. Like, it's so human. Right. But yeah, I definitely was taught that the devil could some way influence you. And that was meant to be interpreted in such a way that my experiences with depression and anxiety were invalidated. They were never taken seriously. They were never deferred to psychological experts. They were always a spiritual issue. Everything is a spiritual issue. Everything. Any problem that you have, your Christian friend will listen to you, and then they will pray for you. They will not give you advice. They will not help you analyze the situation. They will not help you understand the self-care that you need to do. They will not help you understand the boundaries you need to set with someone. Fuck boundaries. There are no boundaries. You are just a slave. I don't mean to use that word lightly, but we did use that word in Christianity. There was a lot of praising of slavery, as a matter of fact. Like, we idealized ourselves as slaves to God, and we thought that was this, like, fantastic thing. And so there's a complete removal of your identity, a complete, I don't have control over myself. And so this is an ongoing topic for people who are recovering from religion or other social constructs that are anti-autonomous, that are that are pro-shaming, that we struggle with regaining some kind of sense of autonomy, some sense of self, some kind of connection with our own bodies. A lot of us struggle with this chasm of like our mind, aka spirit, splitting from our body because we were told that the body is this like fleshy, sinful, like this is disgusting. This is the manifestation of sin. The only thing that's pure or beautiful about me is my spirit. And that's only because I think the right thing. And that right thing is that Jesus died for my sins. But like, there's so much in Christianity about like, you don't deserve any of this. You know what you deserve? You deserve to go straight to fucking hell and burn for all of eternity. That is what you deserve. And the only reason that you're not going to go is because Jesus loves you.
And so now you're going to spend the rest of your life saying thank you.
Yeah, thanks God for not killing me, I guess. Like, and it never dawned on me how abusive that kind of a relationship is, because God was exempt from human relationship analysis. Like, I could be a therapist, a Christian therapist, and understand what abusive relationships are, but then not see that parallel within my relationship with Jesus, because he's immune from all of this evaluation. He's always right. You're always wrong. And it's very kinky that way. There's a lot of sub-dom stuff going on with Jesus that people are really into. Like, they dig it. So it's fucked up. And that's the kind of stuff that I was taught. And some of us are hurt deeper and more profoundly than others. I've met a lot of people who have recovered and got over it in like a day. I've met a lot of people who struggle with it ongoing every day, like myself.
As you were saying it, the thing that was coming up for me is that this version of religion, that your experience of religion, the version that you're telling us, because everybody has their own, but like what you've experienced is incredibly toxic. It's toxic and it's abusive. And it's, as a child, to be told those things, it's violent, it's aggressive, it's based not only in shame, but also deep fear, like fear for your life, fear for your well-being on this earth and wherever you're going to go afterwards. Like, it's this endless, like, there's no sense of safety. There's no sense of acceptance. There's no sense of stability. There's no sense of community in the, you know, all the teachings that you're describing right now. I can imagine for a child is so disturbing when we're trying to find ourselves, when we're trying to feel safe so that we can develop a sense of self, sense of identity, maybe expression, all those things. When you're told like essentially your existence is rooted in fear, it's so toxic. It's so bad.
Yeah.
There are two childhood stories that come to mind that illustrate exactly the point that you're making. One is, you know, again, when I was an adolescent and I was within my own sexuality, I was about to say struggling with my sexuality. And that's really looking back. And it was a struggle because of this dynamic. It wasn't necessarily a struggle because it should have been. And I would not want to touch myself. I would not want to give in. I would not, and they would be like battling and crying and praying about it and negotiation with God. I told God that, you know, if I was meant to have 3 children, that every time I masturbated, he could take one of those children away and I would only have 2 or what. Like, I was trying to figure out what were the ways in which I could ensure that I didn't do this thing. And then every time I did it, I mourned the death of my future child that I had given up to God because I couldn't control myself.
Oh no.
And I have a younger brother and sister, and I remember my sister and I are 8 years apart. And so let's say if I was, you know, 16, she was around, you know, 7, 8. And I remember after it became a practice, I would masturbate. I would run to her room to see if she was still there because I was convinced that the second coming had come, that Jesus had come. And when the Jesus comes, all the children are taken away. And I would always check to see if she was still there to see if I was safe. And like, and so to your point, there's just this inner battle. And so because of all of this mind fuck that was happening, I experienced a lot of depression and anxiety as a kid. Shocker. And I would have conversations with my parents and I would be really, and I have a master's degree in social work and I'm a change strategist and work with people around navigating through change and outside of oppressive situations. And, you know, and part of that certainly is rooted in my own childhood. And I knew at an early age, I needed help. I needed therapy. I needed to talk to someone. And I would say, I wrote a letter to my parents once and I slipped it under their door and it said, instead of Christmas gifts, this year, I want you to send me to therapy. Whatever money you were going to spend on a gift, please send it on a therapist. And I remember putting it under their door and going to bed. And I remember them waking me up in the middle of the night. And Marie knows exactly what happened next. They sat next to me and they prayed. And they prayed that, you know, God would make sure that I would feel okay and, you know, and healthy and happy. And that was it. And we never discussed it again.
What age were you? Older than 10, younger than 10?
Older than 10. Mm. I was older than 10. Mm. But I was younger than 10 the first time that I asked to see a therapist. So when I was probably around 8, I remember going to my parents' room and getting the yellow pages and finding an ad for a child psychologist. And I remember, because it had a picture of like a stuffed animal on it. And I was like, ooh, this looks like the one. And I remember taking it out and putting it in my diary. And I thought to myself, I'm going to save all of my money, save every Christmas, birthday gift, everything that I get so that I can afford to go to the doctor. Cause I was like, there's something wrong with me. I have to go to the doctor. The doctor has to fix it. Somebody has to fix it. So I knew from before 10, that was the case. And then when I was in my adolescence, I slipped that note under the door. They prayed for me. And I remember at the time thinking, if my body was broken, would we just pray to Jesus to heal me? Is it because you think my mind and my spirit is broken that you think that God can hear me when a doctor cannot? And I just felt so hopeless. What it creates is a sense of like, not just fear, but hopelessness. I am broken and nothing can be done because we keep praying. I'm praying, you're praying, we're all praying and nothing is changing. Mm-hmm. I just feel worse. I feel worse than I did before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. My ongoing thing like that, I mean, sexuality definitely was one of those things for me. The larger overarching issue for me that was this repetitive, cyclical trauma, gaslighting, crazy making stuff was that I doubted it all. I, you know, started doubting all of it at age 13. But I've been realizing recently I was right. I look back at that 13-year-old who had these doubts and I love her so much. I'm getting teary because like she was right. She was right to ask those questions, you know? Like if I could have ventured from there and had this like authentic journey of exploration of the world with no question that I couldn't ask, with no conclusion that I couldn't come to, with all the support from everyone who loved me for my journey, what a different life I would have. You know, right around 13 or so is when I started noticing my sexuality. I think I started coming of age or into pubescence around the time when internet became a thing and it became a household thing. I can remember like watching movies with my parents and like there'd be a sex scene or something and I could feel it in my body like, whoa, tingly, what the hell is going on? And like, and now I can't get turned on by those movies anymore because they're so poorly done. And as a photographer, I just can't sexually get into it anymore. I'm like, the lighting and the sound is all off and they're not even talking about consent. So like, I'm just done. But but like, yeah, I know I remember getting really turned on by movies, where there was sex or shows where there was sex. I would always kind of like look for HBO at night to see if there was any sex scenes going on. And then I would feel terrible moreover, if I was watching the scene with my family, my dad has this way of like, if there's something on TV that he doesn't approve of, he'll go, like he does this little grunt, which sometimes is accompanied by changing the channel. Sometimes it's not, but like if there's swearing or there's an off-color joke or there's sex on TV, like, and that's how you knew that this was not okay. And if you're feeling tinglies in your groin right now, then you're part of the problem. And so I received those very subtle messages of what's okay and what's not through my dad and through my family that way. But in the meantime, I'm going into the shower and learning what it feels like to have the shower head come down, you know, over my vulva area and being like, oh, that feels nice. And I was engaging in fantasies about cartoon characters that I really, really liked, you know, having sex with me and like even BDSM fantasies at a very young age about being tied up by, you know, Shredder from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Like they were part of my fantasy landscape at the time. And I would have these fantasies about these characters and just looking back, I'm like, that's really sweet. Like that's so sweet. And I should have felt safe to do that. But then afterwards, like the sensation of your vulva, your the whole space after being stimulated, there's kind of like this vibration to it that you feel for like 15 to 25 minutes or so. That became associated with shame because I would do this behavior and I'd feel bad about it, but distracted kind of at the time that I'm doing it. But then afterwards I'm done and I'm like, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh shit, oh fuck, I did it again, I did it again. And just like you, Jacqueline, I would enter into this negotiation with God. Like I would just plead and be like, I'm so sorry. Like, I know I'm supposed to wait for my husband. I know that like masturbation is not okay. And like, I drank that Kool-Aid. I guzzled that Kool-Aid. I had no doubts that masturbation was wrong or anything sexual before marriage was wrong. I was told very explicitly that sex is a huge thing and that we should wait to have sex until we get married because otherwise people are going to destroy us. Like partners are going to destroy us unless they are ready to get married to us, then it's okay. But like, otherwise, how do you know that this relationship isn't going to end and you're going to lose a little piece of you or maybe a big piece of you? And so they made it into such a big deal. And so it's not surprising now that as I've become non-monogamous, that I'm deconstructing all of that. And I'm allowing relationships to be what they are and to set my own boundaries and to trust myself to handle emotions that I have and allow other people to have autonomy and allow myself to mourn when me and someone else don't have the same interests in terms of how we want our relationship dynamic to be, aka a breakup. Like that was me last year. Someone broke up with me. They were self-aware and came to terms with the fact that they just weren't feeling those feelings for me anymore. And they wanted to be honest about that and allow us both to continue on our own way. And I had a lot of people in my life being like, wow, what kind of excuse did he give? Wow, what a dick. Like, and that is culture at large. People like to demonize their partners, their ex-partners, because how dare you leave me? How dare you rip yourself away from me? Instead of being like, okay, I'm sad because I still was having fun in this relationship. And I'm sad that we don't have that goal in common that we get to collaborate on anymore. But you have autonomy. I trust that you know yourself. So I'm going to mourn this. And thank you. Thank you for everything that we had together. So I don't know what it is about Christianity or those kinds of value systems that make it into something that it doesn't need to be. But it also bleeds into our culture too. So you can't just say this is just a Christian issue. Maybe some of the specifics of purity culture are specific to Christianity and other kinds of religions that are very fundamentalist like that. But also culture in general promotes a relationship dynamic of codependency and of your value being wrapped up in who is your partner, for how long, how much do they love you, did they leave you, what are they willing to do for you? Or will they die for you? Are they going to move in with you? Are they willing to let you meet their parents? Like there's all this like qualification of relationships instead of allowing things to kind of be almost like anarchy to allow us to be what we are to each other and to value what that is. And so that's a lot of the stuff I've been deconstructing around sexuality and relationships and boundaries and autonomy within relationships.
So I want to explore that some more because I think what I'm interested in some of the work that you've done is around how do we think past our socialization? How do we realize that we are surrounded and nurtured and saturated by particular culture and dogma and socialized concepts and that we can't, to your point earlier on, can't escape them or be free from them, but we can more think more critically about them. And you and I have taken somewhat different paths, it sounds like, as it relates to faith and religion and spirituality, where I have tried to detach myself from
some of the specific dogma that felt traumatic in my youth and still capture and hold on to elements of faith and spirituality and the community that really did feed me. And so in raising my daughter, I remember a few years back, we were talking, she was looking at some cartoon and there was like a devil character. And I was like, oh, do you know who that is? And she's like, I don't know. Like a bad guy? Like, I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. And I was like, do you know what sin is? And she's like, no, I don't know what that means. And I just felt really so proud, frankly, that she had no idea who the devil was or what sin was, but she does understand God. She understands, you know, faith. She understands spiritual community. Like these are things we've prayed together. So she, I've been able to figure out for myself, and I'm still in the process of figuring out, how do I capture the things that fed me and helped me feel connected to the universe and to other people and humanity without all of the shame that came along with, and it's not easy, but that's been a little bit of my journey. I'm interested in how you have tried to think past your socialization and untangle yourself from some of the things that you experienced.
Weed.
We just found common ground between us, Marie. Yeah. It's not a religion. It's not religious background. Yeah. It's weed. That is the answer to pretty much everything.
God made weed too.
It's not God is weed, everyone. No, that's not true. There is no one answer. I'm sorry. Before you expand on that, I want to just add to that question because that's exactly what I had in mind. By the way, this also goes to how Jacqueline and I have now share one vision and one thought, even though we are miles apart. No, so exactly what Jacqueline is asking, I just wanted to add the thing that you're saying, which is this very grounded, very wholesome approach to relationships where you are not attached, like what you're describing is a lack of attachment. In a Buddhist way, meaning like you love somebody, you let them be, you are who you are, you come in a union, collaborate for a while. If it works, great. If not, you go on your own ways. You know, you're in this, you know, if we spoke in like psychological attachment terms, very secure attachments, right? And the definition of a secure attachment is that my safety, well-being, and the sense of self is not tied into somebody else, right? And so that is an amazing place to be for somebody who's had, again, in air quotes, a regular upbringing, right? For both of you to come from, you know, what some people would call the opposite of that, like a traumatic childhood upbringing with all this dogma and toxic stories and narratives that's really coded directly into your mainframe, like into your operating system. Coming from that place to where you are now is a massive journey. And just that's like what Jacqueline is saying, I'm really interested in what it took because I think whatever it is, everybody needs it. So I'd love to know what it is. And just before you answer that, I want to just kind of do a little, put in some facts. Historically, the rise of monogamy and the heteronormative union is actually aligned with the rise of Christianity. It is a Christian idea. Before the rise of Christianity, monogamy was not a part of relationships or marriage. Neither was heterosexuality. There are recorded stories of men getting married to one another, women getting married to one another, or two-spirited native folks getting married to one another in union before Christianity came along. Nobody questioned that. And then Christianity came along and we went into this era of heteronormative, mononormative relationship structures and marriage in the eye of God. Not even civil service, but marriage in the eye of God has become a thing. So it is tied into Christianity. So that's, you know, if you look at other religions, Abrahamic religions like Islam, there's a multi-spouse situation mostly. That's not good either, but I'm just saying it was around.
Well, and what's interesting about that is polyamory and polygamy exist in the Bible. Now we're like, well, that's context. That was then. But mm-hmm. then if there's anything negative about homosexuality in the Bible, we're like, well, that one lasts forever though. Like that idea is forever.
Because it suits me.
Right. Yeah. We can eat lobster now. I mean, and we can wear mixed wool, like mixed
cherry pick.
Right, exactly. But like that homosexual thing, no, that's for like right. That's a thing.
Yeah. That makes me feel icky.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Sorry. So yeah, tell us what got you here. Tell us the magic formula.
We need. I mean, you know, I'm excited to share this part, and at the same time, this is my trauma. What I mean by that is that 13-year-old that I was talking about who had a fork in the road where she was ready to explore the universe and then took the road more traveled of self-doubt and keeping her head down and doing what culture told her to do. Everything from that point till now is my trauma. So I'm happy to share that. And at the same time, it's the part that I resent that I ever had to fucking go through in the first fucking place. So that said, how did I get through it? I don't know. I mean, like, there is no good answer. I think if you want a succinct answer, it would just be don't give up. Like, that's one thing that I can say about myself. I'm always committed to growth, self-growth. I was committed to that even when I was a Christian. I was hardcore in that way. Like, I was like, God, I'm going to do good for you. Like, I'm going to really try to do my best here. And like, I was a good kid, as it were, the kid of God. I was really interested in doing the right thing and pushing myself against my own inclinations. So I've always had that value, even when I was Christian. And that is what made me end up becoming even more of a fundamentalist when I was Christian, because I doubled down on Christianity when I did have my doubts. I took that other road and got into even more extreme versions of Christianity than the one that I was raised in, and ended up moving to Mexico after high school to become a missionary, preaching in the streets, converting people, leading them in the salvation prayer, doing that for 2 years. And that traumatized me even further. And so that's what I'm saying, like, this road that I took led me to more trauma, which that period of time in Mexico, just succinctly to say that that was incredibly traumatic. It was more sensationalist, more mystical, more gaslighting, more absurd pseudo-religion stuff, and the invalidation of other identities and appropriation and white savior. There's a lot going on there. But eventually I left that, and that kind of began the journey in 2003 of coming to terms with my behaviors and the things that I chose to do during these times. And so one of the first things I did was date a guy. That was my rebellion against missions work that I had just left. 3 months later, I met a guy who I figured was the only guy who would ever be attracted to me. So I made out with him. I had sex with him. He wasn't even Christian. And I married him. And I was with him for 5 years. And in his own way, he was abusive. We're on friendly terms now, and I think he's growing. But I flushed 5 years down the toilet with this very unhealthy relationship, which was ultimately a huge distraction from the trauma that I was not unpacking from religion. And I knew I needed help. I had an eating disorder that was flaring back then. I mean, I guess that's when I started therapy. So therapy, I think, is a key element here in recovering from toxic narratives of culture and of religion. Therapy, committing to never giving up. I think also something that has helped me is developing the ability to tolerate distress within my own body. And that's been something I've had to work on over time. Most of the time now, I can be present with myself when I'm having a really strong reaction. And that has come out of a lot of experience and a lot of practice. I remember one particular night, one of the things that I have in the past done, almost as an attempt, like a childish attempt to deal with my trauma, is to go through my memorabilia, go through old journals, go through old photos, go through old materials from when I was in mission school, and to try to process them with the eyes that I have now and try to see if I could find some kind of catharsis here. But usually what ends up happening is that I get incredibly triggered and go into a space of kind of freeze, like there's the fight, flight, and freeze responses. And I would end up kind of going to this freeze space and curl up into the fetal position and just do this for like 3 hours and just stare at the wall, unable to think, just trapped in my body and in my mind, just by going through old images and that kind of thing. But I remember one time I was going through them, and this is just a few years ago now, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, that I was going through these images. I got incredibly triggered, because the healthier that I get, in a way, the more triggering my history is, because I have a healthier perspective and I can see how incredibly abusive that was. So it's an oddity. It's something I didn't expect. But point being that I was going through this stuff, I got triggered. I could feel it in my body. Most of us know what that feels like, to have that trauma reaction, that just like shutting down and that just tightening up of the core and then the chest. And this just kind of like closing down of the mind and your ability to think. So I was experiencing that, and I could tell I was going to a bad place. No one else was home. And so I was like, what do I do? Because at the time I had a partner who was someone I really needed, because he was almost like a stand-in for my own self-care. Like, I couldn't do my own self-care, so I married someone who would do it for me. And so, like, usually he would be there to, like, be present with me and be that calm, heavy, grounding presence that I needed that I couldn't give myself. He wasn't home. So what do I do? And I just started saying to myself, I can feel this. I can feel this. I can feel this. I can feel this. And so I'm sobbing on the floor and feeling everything. And I'm telling myself, I can feel this. And I needed to hear myself say that, because I can. I can feel this trauma. I don't need to run away. It does hurt. And I still feel it now. I can feel the taste of it in my body. Like, there's just this little taste of it, remembering and knowing. But I know that I can feel it. Like, not like a pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, nobody cries kind of stuff. Not a repressive kind of thing, but an openness, like a blossoming, like, I can let this pain be here and I can keep my eyes open for it. I can keep watching this. I can be present with this. It's scary, but this is what life is about. If you're going to be honest with it, that it's this trauma, it's this pain, it's being with that trauma and that pain. And I felt strength and a new sense of empowerment in that moment, that I didn't think that my trauma was going to get any better, but I started to believe that I could be present for it, that I could breathe through it, and that I could trust myself to handle how it felt. And so that was another key point for me of recovering or whatever and finding a new narrative. Additional things that I have done is to use my voice. And so in about 2016, I came across a podcast, it's also a stage performance called Mortified. And what happens is that people read old diary entries on stage in front of like 300 people. And they're usually very funny and human and beautiful and vulnerable. And it's a stage performance that they sometimes put onto a podcast. It's this lovely, lovely, lovely show. And they started a chapter of that in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, where I live. And I was like, fuck, that sounds amazing. And so I emailed them. I'm like, I have so many journals about my traumatic Christian upbringing. I would totally talk about them. They're cringeworthy. They're so awkward and they're human and they're painful. And so I went in for an audition and we all went through my journals together and they're all like, oh my God. And long story short, they you know, invited me on, and I can't even tell you, standing on that stage in 2016 in front of 300 strangers and reading about my thoughts as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old, struggling with my faith, living in Mexico, trying to convert Catholics to Protestantism, interlaced with mild racist tones. Like, it was awkward. And I spoke it on the stage. And there was something about that, like, this is important. You should know about this. My story is important. And they all listened and they laughed and they were pissed at the moments where, like, the authorities of this missionary school were being abusive to me. They were all like pissed off with me. They were with me. And it was in that moment that it was almost symbolic, like, humanity at large is with me. Like, we are with each other. We are supporting each other. And that was such a cathartic experience. To tell my story, to tell my trauma, and to hear people say, that's not okay. And after that, I was addicted. I was fucking addicted. I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to talk about this. And what this is probably going to change over time. But talking about it is so healing. Even if when you talk about it today, it doesn't make much sense. And like, because I've been talking about it for what, 4 years now? And so people are like, oh, you're so smart with this shit. I'm like, I've been talking about it for 4 years. The stuff that you go back and listen to me from 4 years ago sounds a lot more insecure. There's a lot more shaking in my voice. There's a lot, it's very different, but talking and deciding that your story as a human being is important and it's okay to share about it. It's essential to get validated and to be heard and to understand that you are human and you've gone through a lot. And so after that, I looked for more opportunities. And like we've been talking about, Jacqueline, like I held on to a lot of sexual repression issues from purity culture and Christianity and stuff. And I came across this podcast called Secular Sexuality. And I was like, that sounds perfect. And so I started listening to it, and it was just happened at that time that they were doing this like competition, quote unquote, thing of like listener stories. Like they wanted you to write your story, record it, submit it. And then he was going to decide like, oh, which one is the best story about, you know, your journey with religion and sexuality, or your sexual journey at all. And I was like, I have some stuff I would like to unpack, please. Yes. And so I wrote up my story and I recorded it. And I sent it to the guy, and he's like, holy shit. And yeah. And so he put me on the show. He like put my recording on the show, and I won. I won this competition because like I just talked about my journey with sexual repression and like where I am now. And again, this was another opening to like, it's okay to talk about our trauma. It's okay to, I don't know if I want to say normalize it, but like normalize talking. Mm-hmm. About it and demanding that we be treated with validation, because this is real shit.
You know, what's interesting is I think first of all, we have to have you on again, potentially, because there's so much more. I think like what we can cover in an hour is not enough. Like there's so much more to unpack, but I do want to take some time before we wrap to highlight some of the things that I heard you share in your story around how do we get from here to there? Like what is the process of beginning to separate oneself and untangle oneself from whatever socialized upbringing and dogma that they have heard. And so what I heard you say was first have a sense of self-empathy, look back at yourself and with love, and as opposed to the shame that you may have been taught in religion, to really look at yourself with self-empathy, know that you can survive the pain, that you can get through it, that this discomfort is something that life has discomfort, and that we have to get used to the discomfort, and that we can survive it, and that we can have hope. I heard you say that we should not ignore or lose our inner voice. And instead, really what I heard you say was listen to and find a platform to share that voice. I think throughout this conversation, we've talked about staying curious. Ask those questions, even when you think you're not supposed to, right? That's the premise of Curious Fox, is to stay curious, to then find people who can help you unpack the trauma, find good therapists. We're going to be bringing on someone, her name is DeAndrea Baylock Johnson, and she also works with folks who have religious backgrounds, and she focuses on Christianity and sexuality and healing in her work. And we have a workshop coming up with Thomas Whitfield, who is going to be helping people figure out how do you find the right therapist? How do you find someone who knows about consensual non-monogamy, who can talk about sexual trauma? How do you find the right therapist for you? So find a therapist or a coach that can support you through your journey. Find community and stories of thriving. You've talked about finding podcasts and blog posts and people that part of what keeps us stuck in a particular socialized construct is because we believe if we leave, we'll be alone. And if you can find other community that can support you, and the way that you do that is to find other stories of thriving, and then essentially find what works for you, right? So you can find a church that's aligned with your values, or never go back to church. You can maintain religious tradition or practice spirituality, or have no spiritual practice. That there is no one way of being. Find the way that aligns with what your inner voice is saying, what thriving feels like for you, and just do that with curiosity and do that with awareness and do that with self-connection. That's what I continue to hear resonate from your story.
Yeah, because maybe the purpose in life isn't to know where you're going, but to follow, to be excited about where this little creature is going to take you. Like that's the excitement. Like, where is it going to bring me? Not to know where it's bringing you.
Yeah. And Marie, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. It's so powerful and it's so important. And I can guarantee it's being heard by someone who needs it right now, because this is so ingrained in our culture, in our society. There are people who come from similar backgrounds to you and Jacqueline, there is a high potential that this is the podcast that someone's hearing for the first time. It's getting them to sort of think and maybe become aware of what's happening to them and what kind of, at least get them to become curious and start asking questions in their own communities and their own situations. So I really, really appreciate that. For those of you who are listening, and if you want to know more about Marie, you can find her on her website, mariedelefant.com. That's mariedelefant.com. For her podcast, to hear more about this stuff and more about where she comes from and how she's dealing with all this stuff, check out her podcast, Everyone is Autonomous. The website for her podcast is everyone'sautonomous.com. And if you want to see her photography, her activism photography, you can find it at Marquee Photo. And it's MarkeePhoto.com. I really, really recommend you follow her, you visit her websites, check out the podcast. I think this is really important, especially for those who are impacted by this kind of religious dogma and upbringing and the consequent trauma. You can also keep following us. We'd love to have Marie back on again. We'd love to keep exploring this intersection of religion and sex and love and relationships and see different stories, different backgrounds of this particular topic. You can follow us at We Are Curious Foxes on pretty much anywhere, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Patreon. You can Google We Are Curious Foxes and we'll pop up. You can also become a Patreon member. As a Patreon member, depending on the tier in which you join, you have access to all of our videos and recordings. Curious Fox Podcast just reached over 16,000 downloads. So we're really, really excited about that. So one thing that would really help us with the podcast is if you like and review us on Apple Podcasts and share the podcast and let people know. It really does make a difference for us. We do want to change the noise, and changing the noise is all about bringing different perspectives, bringing different stories to you to just provide a different point of view that we might not get in the mainstream prescription of how we talk about these topics. You can also reach out to us if you have any questions that you would like for us to explore on the show. There are many ways. One of our favorite ways is to give us a call. We'll play your question and we'll answer it on the podcast in one of the upcoming episodes. And you can give us a call on 201-870-0063. That's 201-870-0063. As always, you can reach out to us pretty much anywhere, share your ideas, tell us which episodes has helped you on your journey, or just tell us that you're listening by emailing us also. You can email us at listening@wearecuriousfoxes.com. That's listening@wearecuriousfoxes.com. We will keep doing this. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, stay curious. Curious Fox Podcast is not and will never be the final word on any topic. We solely aim to encourage curiosity and provide a space for exploration through connection and story. We encourage you to listen with an open and curious mind, and we'll look forward to your feedback. Stay curious, friends.
Stay curious.
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 Stay curious.